There are all kinds of sketchy websites out there that'll tell you for a few bucks what you should be doing with your life. And apparently, I'm missing my calling as a veterinarian rock star feng shui consultant. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is In the Loop from the UBS Forum here at Minnesota Public Radio. And I did not make that result up. Seriously, I answered a few dozen questions, like whether I tend to experiment or follow traditional approaches, and if I enjoy solitary walks. And the site spit out half a dozen ideal careers for me. A ways down the list, I got news anchor, which I suppose is maybe about as close as they get to what I actually do. But evidently, I'd be even better off telling people the most zen-like spot to put their love seat. Tonight, we take on a topic, though, that's as serious, really, as the meaning of life. Namely, what do we do with by far the biggest chunk of our waking hours? Aside, of course, from surfing stupid websites. How do we find work we're not just good at, but that resonates with our souls? And should we try to? This is a bigger issue than ever. 7 years ago, Americans passed the Japanese to officially become the hardest working people in the industrialized world. Even with vacations and holidays, we still average 40 hours a week on the job. So up and down the income ladder, we're working our butts off, and for what? A majority of Americans say they don't like their jobs, and the unhappy horde has grown every year for two decades now. Younger workers are especially likely to feel their work is not working for them. Now, I know there are people who say, so what? Quit whining, sonny. Now, there's a point of view that work is a paycheck, not some sort of day camp where we're all supposed to feel good about ourselves. It's probably true that until recent decades, self-fulfillment through work was a luxury reserved for very few people. But it's hardly a brand new idea. Thinking about this show, I remember the battered copy of Studs Terkel's book, Working, that I keep under the seat of my car for when I'm out on the road working myself. Terkel interviewed dozens of working people 35 years ago from all walks of life, and he wrote this. Work is about a daily search for meaning, as well as daily bread, for recognition, as well as cash, for astonishment, rather than torpor. In short, for a sort of life, rather than a Monday to Friday sort of dying. You can think of tonight's show as kind of an update to working, with many stories coming from those of you in the audience who helped produce our show. We'll hear from a pilot, a janitor, a teacher, a guy who spends his days shredding paper. Will present perhaps the first odes ever written and performed by a state tax auditor and an airport security screener. We're going to dwell on how the jobs we hold relate to our true selves, and we've got some coaches here who can give us a little advice on achieving that harmony. Along the way, our house band, The Smarts, and I have a couple new tunes for you, and of course, our audience members here in the UBS Forum will get in on the action. So, whether you're with us by radio, computer, podcast, or here in person, thank you for joining us in The Loop. Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by the Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. In the Loop lives online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. Pay us a visit there if you can. We labeled tonight's show, Are You Your Job? But really, I think that's almost a rhetorical question nowadays. For good evidence, you don't need to look a whole lot further than a speed dating session. Earlier this week, here in the Twin Cities, where singles had exactly 3 minutes to introduce themselves to each other.
So where do you work?
I work at a consulting company.
I work at US Bank.
I'm a financial consultant.
I teach math.
I work at a medical supply company.
I'm a firefighter.
Oh, you are?
So, yeah.
So what do you do then?
Well, we've all been there. I mean, this is what Americans fall back on to explain who the heck we are. It's a really, really hard habit to break. And I'm wondering, is there anybody in the room here in our audience who could take a stab at it? I mean, how would you explain who you are without making reference to the job that you do? Anybody? We actually asked some other listeners who joined us a couple of weeks ago to talk about the theme for this show to give it a shot. Here's how they did.
I'm not sure I care to share anything that is more personal.
Make reference to how I got invited to the party, who I know at the party. Like, oh, I was invited by him over there.
I try this often. It goes something like, hey, I'm Kristen. You know, I live in Uptown, hang out with my friends. I like to be active in sports. oftentimes it feels like I'm introducing to be someone's girlfriend.
Why is this so hard? Anybody have any theories? Or why are we so attached to using our work to describe who we are?
Angie from Woodbury. A big part of your identity rests in what you do because that has value, measurable value. And I've noticed if you have a tendency to describe yourself in terms other than what you do, people assume either you're unemployed or you're not employable or for whatever reason they devalue what you do.
My name is Leah, and I'm from Uptown. We're peacocking, really. I mean, it's showing our feathers. It's saying, I am this person, and this is the job that defines me, or this is the job that I've chosen to define me.
Who here likes to talk about their work? Well, we got a number of people.
I'm Elizabeth, and I'm from St. Paul. I am a high school teacher, and so... My job is an endless mystery. And so it's great to talk about things that are mysterious.
Clearly you feel like your job is a part of you. You identify with it.
You bet.
So when you tell people you're a high school teacher, what does it say about you?
I think people believe that I'm really brave. And of course the counterpart is that I'm nuts.
Either way, it's interesting conversation.
I think both are true.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thank you. Anybody hate to talk about their job? Yeah, right over here.
Hi, I'm Steve from Minneapolis. I'm a software developer, and I only say that I hate to talk about my job because it's a highly technical one. So it's very difficult. I say, hi, I write software that drives medical devices. And people say, huh, cool. And then that's it. That's the end of the conversation, and I feel bad, you know.
Do you feel like it's cool?
Oh, I think it's really cool. But, of course, it requires... you know, so much background to be able to talk about in, I don't know, in an intelligent way. So it's difficult for people to figure out how they can relate to my background.
Is there anything that you do to kind of, you know, soup up the experience for yourself, make it feel more lively, more fun, or is that not?
Yeah, I listen to Zeppelin at full volume all day long. It works. It's really cool.
And Zeppelin, obviously, is something that comes from some other part of you, right? Not the one who writes code.
It gets you energetic anyway about what you're doing.
Well, that's a nice example to lead us into what's next here in the show. To move us ahead, we've got a snapshot of a guy who took a job that many people would find less than ideal, I think. And he had the guts to make it fit his real passions. Producer Curtis Gilbert brings us this story.
So imagine yourself at work. You're at the office late one night. Everyone else has gone home for the evening. And then from somewhere down the hall, you hear this.
I don't want to be chained. I don't want to be chained.
It's a guy. And he's not just singing, he's wailing.
No to her love.
And then you remember. Oh, yeah. It's just the guy who cleans the building.
My name is Jason Shannon, and I tell people when I first meet them that I write songs.
A year and a half ago, Jason wanted to start recording his songs. So he bought some equipment and was planning to set up a studio in his apartment. But that didn't work out.
So there's air holes and leaks in the room. There's a fridge that buzzes. There's a faucet that drips. There's people upstairs.
The neighbors not only made noise, they also weren't crazy about the idea of Jason rocking out for hours at a time. And then Jason realized there was another place, somewhere he could play late into the night without bothering anyone.
The space at work was real quiet, and one day I just mustered the guts to go into the owner's office.
And he said, can I talk to you? And usually when somebody says that, you think, oh my God, they're going to quit. But Jason said,
you know, with my lips trembling, do you mind if I build a recording studio here?
And I thought, oh, that sounds good, sure.
Miranda Moss loved the idea that the guy who cleaned the carpets and painted the walls at her Minneapolis marketing firm was really an aspiring rock star.
I'm excited. I think one day he's going to be very famous, and we can say, oh, he worked here.
So after everyone else went home for the night, Jason would whip out his guitars, his amps, his keyboards, and he rocked the offices of Yamamoto Moss McKenzie.
Sometimes I'd record till the next morning and sleep in my space.
Three blind men jumped off of a cliff, and they sailed straight through.
Jason's friends would come by and lay down saxophone tracks, trumpet parts. I even pitched in once on background vocals.
Time goes by,
Jason just moved into an artist's loft and brought his studio with him. But he still loves his job. The people are cool, and they support his music. I know a lot of artists, and most of them have some kind of other job that helps them pay the bills. But Jason's the only guy I know who took that day job and turned it into a dream job. For now. Of course, he'd still love to be able to make a living just playing music. But right now, he's happy.
I don't want to be a maintenance person. It's not part of my image. But I can tolerate doing it because doing that work is letting me do what I love to do. Oh, my dearest son, I
have a story that is one. After thinking about the story of Jason the janitor, maintenance man, I'm sorry, we went looking for other people who try to put a personal face on the jobs they use to pay the bills. Specifically, we put a call out for listeners to send us their work-based poetry, songs, or other creative statements. We got an inbox full of examples of how a paycheck and a passionate human being can coexist. And we're going to have a little bit of fun now, I hope. We asked some of our favorites to join us tonight for the show and to bring us inside their world a little bit. First up is Carrie McDonald. And Carrie, what do you do for a living?
I am a sales and use tax auditor for the state of Minnesota.
That sounds fascinating. What an awesome... No, really, that's kind of a boring job, isn't it? Right? People, I mean, like, it's hard to get people psyched about that.
It is sometimes, you bet.
But, you know, when we read your poem and the way that you conceive of your auditor job, you know, my producer and I both had the same thought about what we can add to it just to spice it up a little bit. Kind of a sound texture from our band, if they'll help us out. A little something like this. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That says auditor to me, I think. Anyway, you'll see in a moment what we're thinking here. Let me introduce Carrie McDonald, state tax auditor.
Not by choice, but rather by submission. Here I come, and I don't get a commission. When I call, you will wish that you were dreaming. But oh no, too soon you may be screaming.
Auditor, 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 auditor.
Yeah! With abacus, I stress over your books. What a mess! Next, I must deliver news which shall make you quiver. A few years back, we changed the rules on you. Now you owe with penalty and interest too.
Auditor, 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 auditor.
Please have a nice day now. Compliance is no fun. I wish I could have helped you instead of made you stunned.
Auditor, auditor, auditor.
But
auditor,
I am auditor, the auditor.
Auditor.
An auditor for the state of Minnesota. See, being an auditor is awesome. I don't know what you guys all were thinking. Next up, we have Gabe Heller. Now, what job were you doing at the time when you wrote this song you're going to do for us tonight?
I was working security at the airport, so I was checking people's shoes and looking in their bags a lot.
Mm. So you're all wearing the same uniform, mm-hmm. right? You got a zillion rules to follow in that job. How do you put some of yourself into it?
Well, you open up that little box where you locked your nosy neighbor in yourself in at a young age, and you let them out on a very strict leash.
Well, this is what that song is about. Kind of a cool way of Gabe, you know, really getting into his job, working security at the airport. Gabe Heller, everyone.
People collide at the airport. The rich run right into the poor. If you work there, you've got maybe 30 seconds to try to even up the score. Some folks, they swoon when the football team comes through. Some folks just do their job, professional style. Some folks treat those bigwigs just like they're spoiled children. Me, I just mouth off with a smile. One day I saw Prince at the airport, but I did not bow down before him, no, no, no. No, I just asked him if I could see his ticket. He just looked at me like, maybe there's one man left in Minnesota who doesn't know exactly who I am. Maybe that's why he made just one more good album. You never know, you never know. Last year I checked Jessica Simpson's purse, but I did not treat her like edits, no. No, I just chatted with her like the girl next door as I sorted through her bits. Maybe that's why she got all serious and stuff, went out to Washington, D.C. to get some credible causes underneath that stylish belt. Maybe it was all because of me. People collide at the airport, yes they do. The rich run right into the poor. And if you're lucky, you've got maybe 20 seconds to try to even up the score. Thank you.
That's Gabe Heller. Last in our group, we've got Alan Staples here. Now, Alan, your take is a little bit different than these other folks. You didn't try to inject some passion into your dull job, right?
No, I think that would be impossible to.
We really appreciated your way of thinking about this issue, and you have an essay, I think, that really speaks for itself. So I'll let you take it from here, Alan Staples.
Sigmund Freud said, "All one needs in life is love and work." Clearly, old Sigmund never had to work retail. I do. And let me tell you, the two just do not mix. During 2 years with my girlfriend, I've had two jobs. One we refer to as my real job. One that I liked, had some responsibility, made decent money, but also worked long hours. And I will admit, at the end of those six-day work weeks, sometimes I would be, well, challenged, shall we say, to have a good time. And then in a flight of artistic fancy, I quit that job. To pay the bills, I started working at a department store. And somewhere along the line, as the stress of responsibility gave way to the grind of mindless tedium, our relationship got really good. Instead of my life revolving around work, it began revolving around the things I love: my girlfriend, my writing, and the Minnesota Twins. And the truth is, after another day spent in my workplace purgatory, I'm just so happy to see someone who is not trying to return worn pants without a receipt that I'm willing to go along with pretty much whatever she says. After all, Freud did not say you need to love your work, only that you need both. Consider this. States where workers report being the happiest, like Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, and Arizona, all rank in the top half of states for divorce rates. And the states with the unhappiest workers, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, all place in the bottom third of divorce rates. And yeah, it's hard to draw scientific conclusions here, but being satisfied with your job probably means you're going to spend more time there. Naturally, this leaves less time to love your loved ones. And maybe those of us with jobs we hate are more likely to cultivate the other areas of our life that bring us joy. I do know one thing. Next time you're out shopping for a shirt or a tie, and you see the guy behind the counter with a far-off look in his eye, know that he's not trying to be rude. It's just that, for him, work may be nothing more than waiting to go home.
That's Alan Staples, who reminds us that kind of a crappy job can be okay, as long as you're getting some loving. We want to thank everyone who sent us work-related poetry, songs, and essays. We've got a bunch more of our favorites up on our website, including a construction worker, an actress, a short-order cook. Pay us a visit at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. While you're there, you can join our community of collaborators and help us design future shows. This is In the Loop, and I am Jeff Horwich. There are some other folks out there who, like Alan Staples, realize the best job satisfaction may actually be found at home. Stay-at-home parents make a tough choice in our society, both personally and financially sometimes. Two people who have made this choice tell us you don't have to hold a job to be deeply defined by your work.
My name is Justin McCarthy. My wife and I got married in the late 90s. I was working 12-hour days. She was working 9 to 10-hour days, and it just was ridiculous how much time we were spending at our work, and just to add kids on that, we just felt it would be a great opportunity for one of the two of us to stay home and take care of the kids. And her career had a greater potential of earning more and going farther. So,
do you get everything in your mouth?
He eats like his mom, not like me.
My name is Mandy Reinert-Nash. I have a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and I then spent a year working at a journal in Madison, Wisconsin, and then I spent a year or two working at Bausch Shalom. And I really haven't gotten back into the field because then I started having kids. I just kind of fell into it. I saw how important it was for them to have me around. And then we had another child. So then it kind of was like, well, we're home for now. And I've kind of just...
There are some stereotypes about dads staying home. People kind of envision the guy with the beard and the old sweatshirt that hasn't been washed in a month, ESPN on TV, and kids' diapers on backwards. And right from the very beginning, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't reinforcing those. Rather than this shaping my identity, I feel that I'm defining this role myself. If somebody were to ask me, well, what do? I usually respond, I'm a stay-at-home dad. But I'm trying to redefine the term stay-at-home dad while I'm in this position.
There's one person in particular at my husband's work that every single time I see her, she says something really condescending about me staying at home. And, you know, I don't think she has any concept of why I do what I do. I don't just do it because I couldn't do something else. I'm really choosing to do it. I definitely feel like being a stay-at-home mom has shaped my identity much more than when I worked in the lab or when I worked at the journal, doing tests and making up solutions and writing reports. And there definitely is much more of a calling that I feel for this.
Tonight's episode of In the Loop is all about that tenuous relationship between our jobs and our true selves. So far, we've heard from people who found creative ways, in some cases, to be personally in tune with their jobs. But polls show that most Americans don't like their work. Well, what then? Well, we asked our house band, The Smarts, to help us capture that feeling that somehow maybe we were meant for more. And imagine the phrase cubicle hell, and maybe it'll help put you in the mind of the main character of this next original tune we have for you. Here is The Smarts with Is This What You Expected? Do 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 do
as I make myself forget all the goals I never met. Did I lose some kind of bet? Don't know who I thought I'd be. Never imagined this was me. And could this be all that?
Smarts are Jimmy Kennedy on keys and lead vocals, Morris Engel on drums, and Tom Peterson subbing in tonight on bass. I joined them on a little saxophone this evening. That song is about being stuck, about remembering what your goals were and seeing them years later still off in the distance. We're going to hear now from someone living that scenario in real life. Paul Piccolel works for a Fortune 500 company in the Twin Cities, and I don't think he'd object to being called a cog in that machine. Paul shared his story with us, and he was scheduled to be here to deliver it to you all, but a family emergency has made that impossible. So our friend, the actor Gary Grooms, has agreed to step in at the last minute and help put us inside Paul's head. So as we continue our show tonight, Are You Your Job?, Gary Grooms presents Paul Piccolel.
You know, working for 35 years at entry-level jobs has led me to believe a person really is defined by what they do for a living. I mean, sure, my fingernails and my good nature are also a part of me, but not in the all-inclusive way that my employment is. For instance, losing a fingernail does not make you a loser, okay? But losing your job pretty much defines the feeling of being a loser. Am I right? So does the constant stream of rejection letters that I get from HR departments all over the country. I do have a job, but it's turning me into someone that I don't want to be. You see, growing up, I was a free thinker. I was a seeker of truth. And now that I'm a full-time bookkeeper, I've somehow devolved into a T-crossing, eye-dottering old fool. Everything has to be by the book. When all I need to do is take one glance at a restaurant tab to divvy it up by person and calculate a tip, everyone there can tell that I am a bookkeeper. I've tried to escape, I've stayed in school, I've networked, I've pounded the pavement for work, but no luck. So I have to accept the facts. I have become the job that I've got. And it's not a cool job like a doctor or a farmer. It's just a job with a paycheck, you know. I mean, I'd like to be able to think that I've made a contribution to society, but I ask you, how many invoices must a man run down before you can call him a man? The answer, my friends, appears to be a lot. From the advantages that I've had, I had hoped to be able to grow up and contribute more to society than just a clever computer, let's say. My fiancée, God bless her, sees things differently. She's a psychologist, and she clings to the idea that I am more than what I do for a paycheck. Isn't that sweet? Yeah, she has other new agey ideas, too. All about how I should enjoy the other aspects of my life, that I can lead a full existence outside of my job. Well, then Monday comes and I crash back to this planet. When she encourages me with these platitudes of self-actualization, I tell her, look, I don't need to be a success. It's being a failure that's the problem. I'll bet my soon-to-be in-laws that they agree with me on this issue, too. But don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm thankful for the job that I've got. I hate to think what I'd be without one. But at least grant me the grace of letting me admit that I'm a failure, okay? I mean, it helps to make for far less complaining and for less envying of those people who are successful. I mean, as a failure, I can even sort of look down on those people who are stressed out by their big deal careers. I mean, a delusional self-image is especially tedious when not backed up by the big paycheck, right? So, as a nobody, I accept that. I accept that I'm defined by my job.
That essay was from Paul Piccolo, read by Gary Grooms. In a minute, we'll have some expert guests with us to help consider whether there's any light at the end of Paul's tunnel. But first, we want to give those experts one more dilemma to consider. Beth Burns is able to join us this evening. Her circumstances may not be as dire as Paul's. In fact, I suspect he'd be kind of glad to have her problems. But her story features a battle of values that many of us, I think, can identify with between work on one hand and life on the other. Beth Burns.
For the last 18 years, I have been one of those truly annoying people who actually loves their job. I worked in the arts. For the last 9 years, in an exciting position at one of the country's top theaters, when the inevitable question, "So, what do you do?" came up, my answer always sparked a conversation. People love to tell me about their first experience seeing a play at my theater, or how their kid thrived because of a program I designed. I loved these responses. They were at the heart of why I love my work. I truly believe that people need the arts to live a full life, that they crave being connected to something that transports them, something larger than themselves. See, there I go again. I love my job, or I should say, loved my job. Recently, I left. And so now I find myself in transition. I don't quite know who I am. It is more clear who I am not. I am not the person who works at a prestigious theater. I'm not the person with tickets to opening night. But I'm also not the person who always turns down weekend invitations because I have to work. I will have to work again soon, but for now, I feel like I'm standing on a precipice. Do I have the energy, the passion for another all-consuming career with another all-consuming organization? Or do I have the courage to throw away my snazzy job title and the exciting work and just get a job? I feel like I'm in one of those cartoons with two characters arguing back and forth on top of my shoulders.
You don't want a job. You want a career. It's who you are. And besides, if you had a plain old 9-to-5, you wouldn't know what to do with yourself.
But think about what you've been missing all these years. You know how you always feel guilty about not spending enough time with your family or your friends? This is your chance to focus on your relationships, on the things you say really matter to you.
For the first time, I am home during the day to watch how sunlight passes across my living room. The other day, I decided on a whim to drive across town mid-morning to visit a friend and her new baby.
You would never have been able to do that on your old schedule. Think about it. You know that calm, happy look most people have? It's because they don't work themselves to death. That could be you. Besides, if you had a career, would you have time for your new puppy?
Yeah, about that puppy. Do you really need something that eats your shoes and wakes you up at 3 a.m.? And what about the fact that your career actually had meaning? I mean, isn't it a good thing to devote yourself to a job when you feel it does make a difference?
I don't know what's next for me. These days, I pay attention to the rate of my heartbeat, the things that capture my interest, the times and the places that I feel most grounded. I look to these signs for clues about which road to travel, and I'm grateful for having wandered off the path, for a moment at least.
A commentary from Beth Burns. This is In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. There's quite an industry out there built upon helping people, like we just heard, Paul and Beth, get from despair or confusion to a job that resonates with their values and priorities. And we've got two folks who do that kind of work with us here on In the Loop to offer a little advice. Off the clock, I hope. Good. Dean DeGroat is an industrial psychologist, and he has been counseling people on their careers for 17 years now in the Twin Cities. And Leisha Grossman has worked for 5 years as a full-time life coach to the rich and powerful, as well as us ordinary people. She's known in some circles as the do-it diva. Where do you even start with somebody who has the ambition to do meaningful work, always wanted to, or had it, but is really on the verge of giving in? Dean?
What I find is that a lot of individuals are lost in the wilderness because they are not connected with values, interests, and a target. And so oftentimes I'm helping individuals refocus towards a target, get a game plan. What are their dreams? What are their passions? What value do they bring to the world?
And how do you help guide somebody like Beth, who we heard from, who's trying to choose between all-encompassing career, but maybe very satisfying in a way, and other life priorities?
The first thing I would say is, what are the other choices? Because if you only have two, it's not really a choice. And all through all the people that we've heard through tonight, there was a choice, whether it was the father staying at home or whether it was, I'm just going to do retail and be fine with it for now. Sometimes it's looking at what is absolutely the most important. And guess what? You can do something different next year.
If someone's in a job, I mean, you have to make money. You must hear this a lot. You know, I have to pay the bills. I have things I would love to do, but, you know, I got to stay the course for now.
Alicia? First question would be, who are you being? What's the legacy you'll leave? That, I think, is the key thing that all of us want to have as an impact in the world before we leave. It might be that the impact is on the person that brought the jeans back, and the way that you treated that individual impacted their life and went on. So that would be my first question. Who you being while you're doing what you're doing?
The sort of ideal balance that so many of us imagine we would love to achieve, this real harmony between what we do and the kind of person that we are, is that really within the grasp of everybody?
I really think that people don't often give that enough thought to begin with. They allow themselves to be trapped in, well, this is the way it's supposed to work, and this is the way my parents did it, my grandparents. And so they really have to step back and realize that in this day and age especially, work, career is really about a dynamic kind of position. It's not just a job.
If there's something you really want in your life, even though it's a pipe dream, my husband's got he'll call it a pipe dream, and we've designed our life around going toward it. And you know what? We're having a blast. Doesn't mean it necessarily will ever happen. It's like 1 in 3 million chance. But you know what? We're alive in the present moment going after it.
We have a question from someone in our in the UBS forum here with us. Yeah.
So much of questions as a statement. One thing I'm hearing a lack of tonight is the self-given sense of purpose as far as providing happiness. You know, people in this culture are so much drawn towards money. Money is the measure and sense of well-being and worthiness and happiness that we've lost sight of what it is to serve. At some point in my life, I realized and had the epiphany that time here is precious. I think I went from that to, I think my record was 10 W-2 forms in 1 year.
Alicia, do you have to bring people beyond thinking about the money and...
I always first ask the question is, what's important about the money? Money is a representation. It's kind of almost not real sometimes. It's a representation for the things you want. I made a career choice once that cut my salary down to a third. And I was the happiest I'd ever been. And like all of a sudden you're like, okay, if I make this shift, guess what? I don't have to dry clean. I don't have to buy the latte on the way to work because I'm not tired. I can do it at home. I mean, there's like all these different things that you end up finding that money actually ends up representing.
Hi, I'm Steve from Minneapolis. My concern is that a lot of people don't have a single thing. I don't have a dream. I have a whole lot of things I like. And for me, it's been very difficult to figure out which things I'm going to commit to professionally to make a living off of them and which things are going to be serious hobbies that I do in the off hours.
What do you want to do first? Not make a decision for life. Especially these days when folks on average are going to have 10 different job or career changes. And I think that's why people freeze up about making decisions, because they think they make a decision when it's really a series of them.
What's the one that brings you the most alive? Start there. And if they're like, well, I only make, you know, $10 a week doing that, is that okay with you? And if not, then, well, let's try something else. Someday I'll write a book called Pen to Paper, Making the Change. Because if you can stop long enough to write down what you're thinking, it'll get you so far.
Let's go back to our audience for one more.
My name is Gordon from Shoreview. What I began to think about was the need to feel useful. If we see it atomistically in terms of myself and yourself, then we're missing the bigger picture, which is the contribution that each of us can and should make to the larger whole of the communities in which we live.
If every one of you tomorrow goes to work or doesn't go to work if you're not employed and show up being the person you want to see everyone in the world being and just be it for one day, see what happens around you. And if nothing, try it for 3 weeks.
When people say, I don't know what I want to do, I often say, well, think about who do you want to hang out with? Who do you want to contribute with? Who do you want to align yourself with? And what kind of environment, what kind of culture do you want to be a part of? And sometimes those two play a bigger part in the career decisions than the job itself.
Dean DeGroat and Leisha Grossman, thank you very much for joining us on In the Loop.
Thank you.
This is In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. Whatever topic we take on with this show, we try to step back and find voices that shock us into thinking about the issue at its most basic level. And for tonight's show about jobs and work, someone mentioned a moment ago the need to feel useful as a component of thinking about these issues. I remembered someplace that I visited for a story a couple of years ago that resonates very much with that point. Accessibility is a nonprofit that puts people to work for whom working is not necessarily a foregone conclusion. The people who work there include adults who were born developmentally disabled or those who became disabled later in life. They do things like document sorting, shredding, data entry. I went back there the other day, and I want to share the voices of three people who remind us why we work in the first place.
Rachel, Minneapolis. I've worked here for 1 year.
Do you like your job?
I love it.
What's the difference between now, you know, working every day, and times when you weren't working?
I used to have a job, but now I do.
What was it like not having
a job? Boring. Sitting at home watching TV.
What changed, do you think, about you when you started to work?
It feels good. I need the money. I don't want people to buy stuff for me. I want to buy it on my own. To go to the Timberwolves game. I love the Timberwolves. And to go out to eat and stuff.
Does it matter to you much what kind of work it is specifically?
No. I just like whatever they give us. Now I'm making money.
Hello, my name is Robert and I'm from New Hope.
What kind of work do you do here?
Shredding. Working is very important. Keeps a person busy. Keeps their mind off things sometimes. Responsibility. Responsibility is a big thing.
Some people would say, okay, you're shredding all day long. Doesn't that ever get boring? What do you say?
It's a fun job for me. You know, the hours go fast. That's not everything. But it's a fast pace, and there's lots of different things that we do here, and I like operating my equipment. People want their stuff shredded, and
it matters.
Yes, it matters. Out in the world, yeah.
My name is Barb, and I'm from St. Paul. Right now, I'm doing what's called indexing, filling in names and file numbers, and we have to make sure everything is in right. And
it's a data entry, basically.
Can't do much else from a wheelchair.
How would you answer one of the questions that we're asking for our show, which is, you know, why is work important?
Paying bills and getting out of the house. That's what it is to me, because I'm pretty much by myself, and it just helps me to get out and be with people.
You look forward to work most days anyway?
Oh, yes. From the weekend, I'm ready to go to work.
You were saying, as somebody who's disabled in a wheelchair, you don't have many other choices?
No. I used to work in a dry cleaning plant, and I can't do that no more. So it's like I'm kind of have no choice at what I do. But I like it.
You're listening to In the Loop. And right now, I want to plumb just a little bit deeper the experience of our audience here in the UBS Forum, if I could. And I'm wondering if anyone who's with us here tonight has ever spent considerable time out of work and would be willing to share a bit about what that experience was for you. Yeah, we've got a couple in the back.
Cara, St. Paul. I had an experience where I was out of work because I was diagnosed with cancer, so I was out of work for 3 years. And that was a transformative experience for me because I really got in touch with how precious life is, and that for me it became, doesn't really matter what I do, it's about people and it's about experiences. And that's how I look at even jobs that I do now that aren't very exciting, but it's about the people that I work with.
What was it like adjusting at first to the idea of not being a working person?
It was really difficult. But there was a lot, I had a lot of time to think about what was very precious to me.
As you went back to work, you think you went back as a different person?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We had another hand up, somebody who had been out of work. Yes.
Leah from Minneapolis, and I actually was just unemployed for quite some time because I am an actress. And we all know that actresses and actors have a, 3% employment rate or something to that effect. I have to say that my experience was very much like yours in that it helped me realize what matters to me in this life. For once, to not work and to be able to experience the world and experience people at a slower pace rather than constantly trying to get things done. Now I'm doing a temp job and, you know, going back to work totally bitter and jaded. But having that time unemployed was frightening for income, but incredible for my life.
Well, this is a good chance to hear a couple of more voices before we continue with our audience. At some point, most of us will confront this question of what we are when we no longer have our jobs to define us. Some people will face it a little earlier than others. Here are two of those folks wondering at this very moment, in fact, what their future identity will be.
My name is Jay Ferris, and I am a maintenance welder for Ford Motor Company. I've worked there for a little more than 19 years. To me, it's almost like a high school type of setting. You go to school with all these people, and your whole life is with them. And then all of a sudden, you graduate, and it's like everybody disperses. When they announced that Ford was going to be closing the plant, shortly after that, they announced that they were going to offer packages to people, and they could pick which package suited them best. And the decision that you make, or that I'm going to make, is going to change the rest of my life. You have to really sit down and think, what is really important? You know, is it the job? Is it the type of job? Is it the company you work for? Is it the fact that, you know, you might be starting completely over again from square one? It's just constantly going back and forth trying to figure out which way is the better way to go. I'm too young to retire, and I got too many years in to walk away from it.
I think we are our work, and it's very hard to know where we fit after we're not officially employed anymore.
My name is Moira Heffron. I worked in special education. I ran a computer lab. I taught English. There isn't the anxiety of worrying about oversleeping of Sunday nights. But of course you miss, or I miss, kids and significance and all of that too. It's up to me now to determine the effect of what I do, or whether... It's like when you go places and people say, what do you do? If you don't have an answer, you wonder and they wonder, you know, what your impact in the world is. When I am in other organizations, there's a tendency to step into the same role, and I want to try not doing that for a while, not to be the one who does the outline and assigns jobs. You know, there are a lot of things that I stopped doing because I simply didn't have time or couldn't pursue them. Parts of me that have been neglected. Parts that have been dormant or set aside.
Let's go back into our audience here in the UBS forum. I want to ask, is there anybody who would raise their hand and say, you came pretty darn close, or, you know, right on to becoming what you wanted to be when you were a kid? Sure, right here in the front.
Hi, I'm Tom from St. Louis Park. I had pretty much my dream job growing up. I always thought I'd be a teacher, a math teacher, and went to graduate school and got a position teaching. And it was a tenure track position, and it became clear that I wasn't going to make tenure, so I had to get out. And everything I defined myself was in being a teacher. I'd been in school, around schools, and then all of a sudden I had to go out into industry, and it was horrible. I don't know how I survived it, actually. I became a software engineer for a while. But fortunately, I stuck with it, and I taught whenever I could, and 3.5 years ago, I found a position, and I am now teaching math again.
It was very hard to leave that behind.
It was, yeah. So
do you think you could ever have come to think of yourself as something other than a teacher?
Not very successfully. You know, I tried.
That story is a great one to lead into one last voice that I want to bring to you as we move toward the end of our show. Lots of us will go through job transitions in our lives of various sorts, and we're going to sweat over our career choices. But whatever obstacles life throws up in front of us, I think few of us are going to have our careers manhandled by fate like Ibrahim.
My name is Ibrahim Abikar, and I am 49 years old. I am from Somalia. I was born in Mogadishu. When I finished the high schools, I had the opportunity to get a scholarship to be trained as a pilot. It was a dream of my life. I jumped at the opportunity and started flying for Somali Airlines in October of 1981. Had this opportunity to meet different people, go different places, you know, meet friends all over the world. And it was the best combination of life, experience, adventure. And sometimes I was even actually surprised that I'd get paid doing for something I always liked and I dreamed. I was flying for Somali Airlines until the Civil War erupted, which was in 1988. I could see that, you know, it was getting to a point where my family's life, and including mine, was in a difficult situation. So the normal course of the action was to leave the country and get away from that kind of threat. When I came to U.S. In 1997, the first thing that comes to your mind is, okay, get a job so that you can send some money back to your family. So I got a job with the Radio Shack at the Mall of America. We were selling all these gadgets, and sometimes you see some equipment of the Radio Shack, which the plane I was flying used to have, especially the communications gears, you know, and it kind of brings back all those golden years you had, you know, back as when you were flying. You know, if there is a friend coming from Africa and they call you and they say, okay, pick me up at the airport. So you go to the airport to pick them up, and you see, you know, a Boeing 737 landing, or, you know, DC-10 Northwest taking off, you know. So just your eyes glued to it. That person who's flying the 737 or the DC-10 could have been me back home in Somalia. No, that's nostalgia. I'm not jealous, you know, because I had my opportunity and things happened that was beyond my control. Some people who knew you back home, even though it's been close to 25 years now, they still think you as the pilot back home. And once they say that, you know, I smile and, of course, I say, yeah, well, you know, that's true. I'm a pilot, you know, because it's one of those titles that don't go away. Once you are a captain, you are always a captain. No matter whatever transitions or whatever other jobs I do, I still identify as a pilot.
A quick postscript. Ibrahim did land another fulfilling job here in Minnesota. For some time now, he's been working for the state, offering employment and economic assistance to other refugees going through the same transition. Ibrahim said it's hard to go out in the community without people thinking of him as a pilot. Now, he doesn't mind that. But as I was thinking about our topic tonight, are you your job, and watching current events, it occurred to me, you know, there's one guy in particular these days who would probably rather you not associate him with his job. Look past the trappings of title and see the real person within. And who could blame him? I'm sure there are days, you know, we'd all like to leave our professional identity behind and just be us. And so I wrote this tune for this guy because, you know, he'd sing it if he could, I think. It's a little bluegrassy number called "That's Just My Job, That's Not Me."
I like to play golf, I'm a family man. Love to watch sports on TV. Now you all like to think that you know who I am, but that's just my job. That's not me. Well, you hear all the time my approval is low. All the bad press never ends. But I'm a wonderful guy. My approval is high among my close circle of friends. For instance, I love to joke, and I sure like to tease as the nicknames I use go to show.
like Scooter and Brownie and old Kenny Boy. Don't I seem like a fun guy to know? You know, it's not like my life is just Iraq all the time. There's so much more that I like to do. I like to go running. I like to clear brush, kick back and watch some football with a pretzel or two. Carefully now, of course, on that one, right? One pretzel at a time. Learn that one from experience. Where was I? Oh, yeah. People look at your work and they start to prejudge. Think that you're this or that way. Yes, I'm the president, and that's a big deal. But that's just 6 hours a day. That's just my job, that's not me. They say everybody looks worse on TV. Take me out fishing and then you will see. That's just my job, that's not me. Once you get in a war, it's like people forget the way you can light up the crowd. One hurricane wrecks one city, it's like nobody cares how your opening day pitch made your old daddy proud. So if I seem testy, if I furrow my brow, if I seem like I'm always annoyed, just remember, we all can get warped a bit by the particular way we're employed. That's just my job, that's not me. I'm so much more fun than that guy that you see. Less than 2 years and I'll finally be free. Oh, that's just my job, that's not me.
Thanks to our house band, The Smarts, Jimmy Kennedy on keys and guitar, Morris Engel on drums, and Tom Peterson tonight on bass. More about them at thesmartsband.com. Go right ahead, applaud for them again. Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com. While we're spitting out web addresses here, In the Loop is online at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Special thanks tonight to Abdi Ainti, Chad Haynes at FastStater.com, and Barbara, David, and Lisa at Accessibility. We had some help gathering the voices on tonight's show from Roseanne Pereira, Molly Bloom, and Joel Gross-Steven. Molly and Joel also helped out with our live show tonight, along with Larissa Anderson. The webmaster for In the Loop is Preston Wright. Alan Frechtman is our technical producer. Sandin Totten, our assistant producer. Michael Scholar is the executive producer of the show. I'm Jeff Horwich, and we hope you'll join us again next month in The Loop.